Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the club and the Environment and Natural Resources Program. Our program tonight is Golden Gate Park Under Siege. It is my pleasure to welcome our moderator, Jim Chappell. Jim is recognized as a distinguished leader in San Francisco, first as the longtime executive director of SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research. Currently, Jim is serving as interim director of San Francisco Beautiful. Jim will introduce our panel. Jim?
Thank you, Ann Clark. Golden Gate Park, a park under siege, treasured by millions of people from all over the world. Golden Gate Park's meadows, forests, and lakes have served as a refuge from the pressures of life, both for both people and wildlife, for over 140 years. Yet throughout its history, the park has attracted those who view it as free land available for their favorite projects, some good, some not good at all. In addition, with today's budget crisis at all levels of government, it sometimes seems like everything is on the table and that some view this precious civic asset first as a source of revenue and only secondly as a public treasure. Tonight we will explore some of the issues that are driving this civic conversation and hopefully add to our listeners' understanding. Democracy requires passionate and robust public argument. In doing so, we seek a dialogue that advances the common good and appreciates and respects divergent opinion. Let me introduce our panelists tonight. First will be Mark Buell, president of the San Francisco Recreation and Parks Commission, the city charter-mandated governing body of the Recreation and Parks Department. He's also chair of the board of the Golden Gate Park National Conservancy and chair of the America's Cup Organizing Committee. And I'll introduce everyone right now. The second speaker the right is Anthea Hartig, Ph.D., director of the Western Office of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a private, nonprofit, 270,000-member organization dedicated to saving historic places and revitalizing America's communities. Next will be Catherine Howard, ASLA, a landscape architect and founding member of the Friends of the Music Concourse, the Park Rangers Coalition, the Golden Gate Preservation Alliance, and San Francisco Ocean Edge, all community organizations focused on protecting Golden Gate Park. Then Mike Lines, Conservation Director and General Counsel for Environmental Matters for the Golden Gate Audubon Society, a more than 10,000-member conservation organization. Last up will be George Woodring, president of the West of Twin Peaks Central Council, a group of 17 neighborhood organizations, a soccer dad, soccer coach and sponsor, a Golden Gate Park supporter, and columnist for the West Side Observer. Each speaker will take 6 minutes to give us their thoughts on the subject. We will then have 15 minutes for questions and answers. And as Ann said, please fill out the question cards. And then at the end, we'll come back and each speaker in a reverse order will have 1 minute to sum up. Mark Buell.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club for including me on this panel. I thought it was important to have a Recreation and Park Department representative when talking about Golden Gate Park. In 1870, William Hammond Hall, the original park designer, defined the park as, I quote, a portion of land with the semblance of natural formation but adopted by art to the requirements of large and varied bodies of pleasure seekers. It is the requirements of a large and varied body of pleasure seekers that we at Rec and Park try to satisfy. And this body will be getting larger in the years to come, and I speak of the pleasure seekers. We know that from an environmental standpoint, urban sprawl is no longer either desirable or acceptable. Every major environmental group and every major planning organization tells us that cities must absorb growth. To that end, we at Rec and Park have a responsibility to accommodate that change. We also know that growth in the population is driven primarily by immigration. As many of you know, if the United States were left to its own without immigration, we'd be a declining population. We have less than 2.2 people per couple in reproduction. It's immigration, and as some of you may know, the Hispanic community in a few years will be the majority of the California population. And I think it's important to know that the growth in the population will bring a great and rich cultural diversity to the city. We at Rec and Park have a responsibility to meet that challenge as well. In addition, the Recreation and Park Department budget has been cut $43 million in the last 7 years. This translates into a shortage of approximately 16 to 30 gardeners in Golden Gate Park, depending on how you define those responsibilities. The reduction of recreation opportunities and the reduced use of facilities. And so we're challenged by concern for the environment, a changing population, and a substantially reduced budget resources. It is in that context that we make decisions at the Commission. According to the most recent Neighborhood Park Council survey of over 1,400 park users, the number one problem facing the park is park maintenance. That is a direct translation into the budget cuts and fewer gardeners. The number one solution that was identified by that survey, 92%, believe that park amenities should be used for revenue generation, and they used an example of bike rentals, but also weighed in with support for vendors, leases, and concessions. It's important, therefore, when speaking about Golden Gate Park, to look at what's the recent record for Rec and Park. In the last 10 years, we have spent over $90 million in Golden Gate Park. $90 million. I could read you a litany of the projects, but I'm going to read the ones that relate to historic resources and contributing features to the National Register of Historic Places. The Japanese Tea Garden, Portraits of the Past, Stowe Lake, Children's Quarters Playground, Concourse Fountain, Concourse Bandshell, Botanical Garden Path Improvements, Bowling Green, Restrooms, Rhododendron Dell, Millwright Cottage, which is in progress, the Polo Fields renovation, the Murphy Windmills, which is in progress, the Park Aid Station, which is in progress, and the others, $3.1 million for the Open Space Fund, $54 million in grants. That's the resources that came to bear, and 15.6 in voter-supported bonds, $12 million in private gifts, 5.1 from the general fund. Other projects include Kezar and Panhandle lighting and improvements, Golden Gate Park compressed natural gas station, the Golden Gate Park County Fair Building, the eastern entrance improvements, the Corret Children's Quarters, the North and South Lakes, the Panhandle restrooms, the urban forestry yard, the bison paddock, the music concourse I mentioned already. So we've had, and then there's lots of infrastructure improvements as well. Now I'm going to get down to 2 minutes here, I see. So I'm going to mention very quickly that the projects that are in contention, the soccer fields, for 75 years those have been sports fields. The state of the art is synthetic turf in all soccer fields in all parks in the country. The debate has gone on, and it's concluded that that is the way to proceed. What that does is reduce the amount of water and maintenance required, but it more importantly increases from 4,738 hours of use a year to 14,340, almost three times the amount. And when you look at the cultural changes going on and the demands in the city for the kind of recreation uses, soccer is huge. See, I have 1 minute left, but I'm going to read. We're in favor of children and we're in favor of soccer, said Mark Welther, executive director of the Golden Gate Audubon Society. But we want to make sure that there's a full and fair hearing of all the environmental issues that need to be considered in order to make a good decision about this. I agree 100% with the Audubon Society. Stowe Lake, I have a National Parks magazine that uses the Muirwoods vendor as the example of what we ought to be doing in sustainability, organic food, and good practices from an environmental standpoint. They want to make that the national model in national parks. That is that's the entity that was selected as the vendor in Stowe Lake. I'm hearing hissing from the crowd. So I guess they don't support sustainable, and there. I'm not going to get to all the projects, so I'm going to say finally that we also closed and soon to be closed the Haight-Ashbury Recycling Center. That is an industrial use in the park. I hear some more hissing. It's an outdated facility. We require
recycling. I'm going to say that I don't want to hear any comments from the audience, okay?
I wasn't expecting applause, but I must tell you that we are trying to make balanced decisions at the Recreation and Park Commission, and I thank you very much.
Okay.
I would, as your coordinator tonight, please, please, please do not hiss or make noises of any sort at this time. You're welcome to applaud and clap as the program ends. If you do have an item that you want to express your concern or judgment about, that's what the program cards are about. So please let's remember that this is a debate and it's a discussion, and it's important for us to keep it at that level. Thank you.
Yes. Anthea Hartig.
Thank you, Jim and Dr. Ann Clark and the Commonwealth Club. Warm greetings to my fellow panelists and to our audience. Thank you for being here tonight. In a place where green space has always mattered, Golden Gate Park stands out as a historic horticultural masterpiece. As Mr. Buell and the Recreation and Park Commission and departments deeply understand as the park's longtime stewards, it is one, clearly, of the city's greatest treasures. It is thus, in my opinion, worthy of all designations, protections, and careful and multidimensional stewardship so that it will have a meaningful and sustainable future. And by multidimensional, I mean the scenic, natural, cultural, environmental, and recreational elements and attributes of a resource of this magnitude and type. As you know, designed by Hall and McLaren in the 1870s, Golden Gate Park boasts an incredible array of historic buildings, sculptures, monument, and landscape features. Our generations, collectively, although it might be nice to see slightly younger generations in the crowd, but hopefully they're online live streaming us right now. We've inherited a Golden Gate Park as one of the most important design cultural landscapes in the nation, if not the world. And a design landscape is defined by the National Park Service as a cultural landscape that was consciously designed or laid out by a landscape architect, master gardener, architect, or horticulturalist according to design principles, end quote. As such, the entirety of the GGP was listed proudly on the National Register of Historic Places in 2004, joining important cultural landscapes like this one that are designated as National Historic Landmarks, which is the highest designation in the empire, local historic districts, and local individual landmarks all across the country. Most of the parks that we think of as historic around the nation, Griffith Park in Los Angeles being the newest, to Fairmont Park in Philadelphia, 9,220 acres with 63 pocket parks, to the Japanese Tea Gardens in Seattle, to the Boston Commons. In fact, any of Boston's parks, if you're familiar with that incredible city, that you might think about or recognize are designated as historic. All of these are local landmarks overseen by some combination of Historic Preservation and Park and Recreation Commission. A little closer to home, Phoenix has 30 parks listed as local landmarks and are subject to design review. Of course, the National Historic Landmark Central Park in Manhattan, which many see as both either a bane of park existence or a model of public-private partnerships, is also a National Historic Landmark and is co-managed, of course, by the Central Park Conservancy, but as well as the New York City's Department of Park and Rec, and has oversight of the National Park Service itself because of its National Historic Landmark designation. Preservation advocacy, I bring this up for Jim and Spur, and thanks to Kathy for finding it for me. Preservation advocacy in San Francisco has long been a critical voice in the city's evolution, whether it be vocalizing concerns against planned freeways, ta-da, 1948, decimation of neighborhoods, or the changes in the financial districts. Some of its parks, like Alamo Square and Washington Square Park, have already received local designation. And the fears of fossilization or amberization, which I don't think is a word, but you know what I mean, in my opinion, coming from both local government and state government and now working for the National Trust, seem far-fetched, almost as far-fetched as saying that somehow Golden Gate Park is not historic. I find it fascinating that if a botanist says, that's an oak tree, we say, oh, right, that's an oak tree. If historians, not in defending my ilk, I know, if historians say, hey, that's a historic place, you're like, oh, really? Are you sure? Yes, we're sure. And in fact, in this case, as one of my dear colleagues pointed out, historians and landscape historians and landscape architects could help discern the cultural significance of said oak tree in my example. So I'd like us to think about collectively local designation with well-detailed accompanying design guidelines that ideally can streamline and manage change in Golden Gate Park. And think about the cross-pollinization or pollination of specializations on each of the Historic Preservation Commission, as well as the Rec and Park Commission. And think about kind of a world where perhaps we can check hyperbole and ego at the door so we could have enhanced decision-making. The Golden Gate Park Master Plan seems to provide an excellent framework. It was incredibly done and well hammered out as it delineates both an easterly and westerly zones of the park. So in closing, I think I have one more minute left, brief thoughts on how to manage in my mind, which has become a heated issue. First, strive for balance. Secondly, base our conversations on facts. Three, amass best practices and ideas from around the nation, state, nation, and globe. And so ideally that we can arrive at a place of collaborative management, both in philosophy and set of practices, that can enact the Park Master Plan, use the expertise of groups like the New Historic Preservation Commission, Audubon, San Francisco Architectural Heritage, National Trust, advocates like the GGPPA, Cultural Landscape Foundation, et al., and all the incredible people who care deeply about Golden Gate Park. And I thank you for allowing me to be here.
Hi, I'm Kathy Howard. And I'd like to build on what Dr. Hartig said. A couple of projects are on the drawing board right now that will have negative impacts on the more wild and forested end of Golden Gate Park. Just across the highway from Great Highway from Ocean Beach and screened by trees lie the Beach Chalet soccer fields. Can we go back maybe to the map just for a minute? You can see the map. The red is the Beach Chalet, and then below it is the water treatment plant. Those are the two projects I'm going to be talking about. And we can go into the meadow. The Beach Chalet soccer fields are right across the highway from the ocean. They are screened by trees. They are in a meadow surrounded by groves of trees and inhabited by wildlife. The playing fields do need maintenance. The golfers are having a field day, if you'll excuse the pun. And we know that it needs maintenance, but it's beautiful parkland, and it's a really great place. You have beautiful trees, you have birds singing, and you can hear the ocean a few hundred yards away. The Beach Chalet construction project will change these fields forever into a hard-edged urban sports complex. It will rip out over 7 acres of topsoil and living natural grass and replace it with artificial turf. Artificial turf is made of about a 6-inch base of gravel on which you put a plastic carpet and then you fill it with old ground-up tire waste. There will be lots of new concrete and asphalt, an expanded parking lot, seating for 1,000, and other built elements. We're going to lose about 55 trees for sure and probably more because I can tell you as a landscape architect that when you get into construction that that's what happens. To cap it all off, there will be 10 sets of 60-foot tall multi-fixture sports lights. The lights will be twice as high as the trees that screen the fields from the Great Highway. So we're going to have these intense stadium lights shining down with 250,000 watts from sunset till 10 o'clock p.m. every night of the year. So you go down to Ocean Beach with your significant other. Maybe you stroll on the beach. Maybe you want to be by a fire ring. Maybe you want to gaze up at the stars, and all of a sudden, wham, the lights go on. It'll be like the mothership landing. A little south of the fields is neglected parkland currently used for construction storage. It's got stuff like piles of gravel and dirt. A second project is proposed for here, the water cycling plant. This will be a 40,000-square-foot facility with a chemical building, 30-foot-tall blank concrete walls, 24-hour lighting, and security gating. Over 200 more trees will be either cut down or threatened. This is very simple. This is an industrial building. It should not be in Golden Gate Park. We've identified alternative locations outside of the park, and we asked the PUC to encourage them to consider these locations during the EIR process. As for the soccer fields, we support youth soccer. We think it would be really great if kids could play on a quality, real grass soccer field. We think the field should be renovated with real grass using modern construction methods, better drainage, good sod, and some kind of gopher controls. Yes, there will be more maintenance, but Reckon Park is pursuing endowments. Let's use one for a groundskeeper for all of Golden Gate Park's playing fields. We think the kids are worth having that experience of playing on a natural grass field. And let's have a broader vision for this whole part of Golden Gate Park. How about new meadows? Have you ever tried to get a picnic table on a holiday weekend? How about an additional grass practice area for the soccer players? How about a native plant reserve, a wildlife habitat? A few years ago, I visited a bulb garden, the Hortus bulborum, near Amsterdam. It preserves the old DNA stock for the original bulbs that were brought from the Middle East hundreds of years ago. So how does it do this? It grows them. The factory is right next to the Murphy windmill, which is being restored in the Millwright's house. They are going to put a restaurant in the Millwright's house. Would you rather eat lunch next to a factory, a chemical building, and a bunch of plastic, grass, and tire waste? Or would you rather do it overlooking a bulb garden? Tough choice. But seriously, Golden Gate Park is a gift from past generations to us today. Let's find ways to enhance it rather than to destroy the heritage we are leaving for future generations. Thank you.
I'm going to have to make another request because we are really on a very tight time schedule that you hold your applause until the end of the presentations. Remember, we want enough time to have your questions so that you can find answers or hear answers from the panel. So the two rules now are no outlandish noises and hisses and things like that. That's rude. And two, please just hold your applause so that we will have the time to really fully explore these issues. Thank you.
So I was invited to help provide some context for the environmental and ecological values of Golden Gate Park and why many in the environmental community are concerned about what we see in the western end in particular is a kind of industrialization and a change. And I think as I talk tonight, when I'm speaking specifically about Golden Gate Park, it really is sort of emblematic of what many of us are concerned about how the parks are treated in general in San Francisco. So in providing this context, I want to let you know a little bit of where I'm coming at this from, or the Audubon Society and many other groups are. And it's a little melodramatic, so you'll have to pardon, but it's very relevant, and I hope you can understand that. We always hear about how we're losing biodiversity, and we read about it, and it's the ice is melting in Antarctica, and the trees are getting cut down in Brazil. But the fact is that we're losing biodiversity in the world, and we're losing it in San Francisco. Reckon Park's website acknowledges this in many places. And the reason we're losing that is we're losing habitat, and we're losing the stewardship, a value of stewardship on how to maintain what's left in the face of growing population pressure, something Mark pointed out, and that will become even more immense as time goes by. So in the end, conservation is not about just worrying about the penguins in Antarctica. It's about what we do in our own yards, in our own parks, in our cities. And it's on us, and it becomes a factor of the kind of communities that we are. So when we begin to get up in arms about what we see as the industrialization of Golden Gate Park, and that's really what this is, at least at the western end, we have a soccer field project which is the ecological equivalent of a 7-acre parking lot. If they were to go out and pave it and lay down asphalt, ecologically, that would be the same thing. So we have to understand that as a loss of habitat and be realistic about it. Now, there are other values that people are getting out of it, and I acknowledge that. But ecologically, it's like a parking lot. And we will be adding an immense amount of traffic, 3 to 4 times the amount of usage, as Mark pointed out. That brings a lot more people and a lot more disturbance to the surrounding area, and the addition of the lights, which I'll get to in a little bit. The wastewater treatment plant sort of expands this industrial footprint at the western end. Now, we're particularly concerned about this because the western end of Golden Gate Park has always been designated to be more wild and more natural. While the park itself was seen as a refuge, that was particularly true of the western end. It was supposed to be wooded and native. It was supposed to be for a place for people who could not get away to Yosemite, or even in the old days, get to the Marin Headlands or down to the peninsula. And it's part of San Francisco's wild space, and there's very little left. So it might be a different issue somewhat if this were occurring in a different park or a different part of the park. But here at the western end, it's one of the last wild places we have left. And because I'm an attorney and a former reformed English major, I can't proceed without quoting someone else's authority to back up my own. Raymond Clary wrote in The Making of Golden Gate Park, "Each new generation and each new social trend places added pressure on the woodland park, originally designed to balance the effects of urban living. Each change serves to defeat the very purpose of the park. It was to serve as a quiet retreat, a natural environment. Although the setting aside of buildings for the specific, setting aside of buildings for specific uses may be important to certain people or certain groups of people, in total, these changes destroy the woodland park. And it still is very much a woodland park and still is very ecologically relevant to San Francisco. When Golden Gate Audubon began as the Audubon Society of the Pacific in 1918, it began with people doing walks in Golden Gate Park. And they would count hundreds of California quail, as well as many other species. And they've been out there counting them for almost 100 years. People are still out there almost every day counting birds and counting other wildlife. And those, today, there are fewer than 8 quail left in the Golden Gate Park and in San Francisco altogether. And again, this is emblematic of our stewardship overall. So it's also an important place for migrating birds, and we know that lights have very significant negative effects. They bring in birds. They have negative effects on their predation. And so all these things are of great concern about how we're going to protect this part of the land. And we know, as I said, that this project will have significant, significant impacts. Now, we know that Reckon Park can do good work. We see it in the Natural Areas Program. They have got a good reforestation program. There's been restoration at the Buffalo Paddock. And I think people like Gloria Koch-Gonzalez and others should be applauded for prioritizing that. But what we have not seen is an overall priority of protecting the land and stewarding it overall. And so, for example, in this project at the Beach Chalet, it was brought to us as this was a fait accompli. It was always going to be artificial turf. There was never any public discussion about alternatives for natural grass turf. And when we brought them up with Reckon Park staff, we were shot down. I think the wastewater treatment plant has at least been a more robust public discussion. And so one of the things that we've tried to stress again and again through this process is try to encourage people to read the master plan, to look at the ecology and look at our own responsibility as individuals for maintaining biodiversity locally and in our parks, and think about what are those values that we pass, not only through things like competitive sports and soccer, but how do we show our kids and our next generations how to respect the land that has been left to us by other generations. Thank you.
George Wooden. Okay,
thank you. I want to thank you, Jim. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and my fellow panelists. I'm going to talk a little bit about budget tonight. The RPD has changed its financial model to become self-sustaining, and new changes in the financial policy have caused the RPD to privatize revenue generation above all other RPD services. As Mark had stated earlier today, over the last decade, the amount of money given to the RPD by San Francisco's general fund has been constantly reduced by the mayor's office. Long before the current budget crisis, San Francisco has decided to make the RPD a low financial priority and started allocating funds that were formerly budgeted for the RPD to other city departments. Now there's a new financial plan. The lower paid operational employees that provided services to the public, specifically the RPD's recreation directors, were fired. Reduced services that have been directly provided by RPD employees to the public. They continue to be reduced. Rent or lease park facilities to private businesses for their financial benefit. According to the city charter, Section 16.107, extra RPD expenditure savings would be retained or kept within the RPD budget and dedicated to helping fund the parks in future years. This is very unusual. If you follow other city agencies, the RPD is the one, I believe, agency that keeps their money and carries it forward. In 2010, almost $10 million in RPD funds were taken away from the RPD and given back silently to the city general fund. The RPD's 2010 $12.4 million deficit could have been greatly reduced by almost $10 million had the city charter been enforced. So we have to think when they say they're going to be self-sustaining, part of being self-sustaining is that the city actually allows them to keep the money that they generate. At this time, no one knows how much in RPD savings are unacknowledged. So under the old RPD budget plan, financial donations would be accepted. The new budget plan, financial donations have now become a top priority or top budget priority. The existing RPD administration has been converted into a sales force by a new informal salary multiplier program that requests that employees generate between 5 to 10 times their existing salary. The children's services budget has been cut by 13.4%, and the RPD's planning and privatization budget has been increased by 633%. 13 new administrative employees were hired in 2010 that make over $100,000 per year, not including a 33% benefit package. The opinions of donors who make philanthropic contributions have become much more important than public opinion to the RPD. It's where they get their money. Park planning has become oriented towards philanthropic money. Examples of the new self-sustaining revenue plan in action. Permit fees have been increased, and this has led to the canceling of events and less usages in some places. It actually generates less revenue. The Stowe Lake Boathouse contract was awarded to an out-of-town bidder that paid consultants that were recommended by RPD employees. The contract was awarded to the lowest bidder, not the highest. And the result is a lawsuit. The Arboretum started charging out-of-town visitors $7 entry fee and promised that this fee would generate a net revenue of at least $250,000 annually. Result, a 44% decrease in local attendance, a 70% decrease in out-of-town attendance. After 8 months, less than $60,000 had been earned, and the Botanical Society has had to pledge the balance of the $250,000 in annual net revenue from their own sources. The proposed soccer field complex will cost between $9 and $12 million. The EIR costs $400,000. Synthetic fields last 8 to 10 years and cost $400,000 to $600,000 to replace. The entire project could have been done for less than $1 million if grass were used. In fact, the last time this facility was refurbished as a grass field was in 1998. I'm going to be quick. the park needs of San Francisco, this is my own personal belief, the park needs of the San Francisco citizens who pay for the parks are now secondary to the RPD's attempts to generate more revenue from the parks. I don't blame them for wanting to make more money because of the current situation, but that's a hard reality. Golden Gate Park was supposed to be a place that the community, the taxpayers, support and preserve for the good of all. Golden Gate Park was never intended to be a self-sustaining or pay money into the city general fund. Once the city decided that the parks would have to be self-sustaining, the whole notion of public space has been destroyed. The new RPD staff now cares more about the money that it receives than the public need or sustaining the parks. Thank you.
Can you hold your applause? I'm going to keep reminding you we want to get as many questions and answers in as possible. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and our panel members who are talking to us about Golden Gate Park. We will now go forward with our questions that have come from our audience, and Mr. Chappell will be asking those questions for you.
Okay. We have many, many questions, and some of them are touching on the same point, so I will use my prerogative to kind of mix and match and generalize some of these questions. But I want to start with you, Mark Buell. There are a number of questions about the financial structure of the park and Recken Park. And going forward 10 years in the future, you know, what do you want to see the financial institutional structure of the park look like, and what is that going to mean for us as users of the park?
That's a great question, and I thank you for it. Basically, the parks are funded from three sources. There's bond money, and there's revenue generated, and there's general fund money, and it's about a third, a third, a third. And the general fund money is in the range of $30 to $35 million, and what I would like to see is a tax structure which takes it out of the general fund, which makes it less subject to the political whims of trying to meet budget requirements. I'd rather see a parcel tax or special assessment, and I think that would be a recognition of the value we place on parks, because we historically get down the totem pole after fire and police and muni and health. And those are the places that people squawk the most if you do the cuts, and so Recken Park gets the brunt of it. I think there are ways, and we have a task force, in fact, that Spur has been heading up for the last 3 months that's talking about this very issue, and there's probably 35 or 40 citizens on it that know lots about the different ways to do this, and we hope to have some recommendations in the next 6 weeks.
Thank you. There's another omnibus question that I'm going to take my prerogative to answer by quoting from the Golden Gate Park master plan, and has been suggested. It is a document very much worth reading. And the question is, does the Golden Gate Park 1998 master plan address the issues raised by the current controversial projects? And the answer is yes. And let me quote from the plan. It says, balancing the off-conflicting objectives of improving conditions for wildlife and encouraging public use of the park will continue to be a challenge. The park's designers, however, made the challenge less formidable by dividing the park into two distinct parts, roughly east and west of Strawberry Hill. Preserving the historic naturalistic design of the park, including this division, a principal goal of the master plan, will also preserve habitat value for wildlife. The eastern park is more actively used, while the western part is more naturalistic and densely wooded. Maintaining this distinction goes a long way toward maintaining wildlife habitat in the park. So William Hammond Hall was very prescient, and the park has been designed to meet a wide variety of uses, and we as stewards of the park that all of us citizens are in the city should make ourselves very familiar with what the plan says and hold all of us to its strictures. I'm going to ask Mark another question because this one is just too good not to ask. It says, we often see the bumper sticker, what would Jesus do? Regarding synthetic turf and the lighting of the soccer fields, what would John McLaren do?
Well, he was a Scotsman, I think. I wonder if soccer was in his vocabulary. It's a very tough question. I think the Audubon Society has raised some very good issues. There's a full environmental impact report going on. There isn't a right answer. There is a value judgment about serving the citizens of the city, and I think once we see that environmental impact report, we'll find out whether there are mitigation measures that can satisfy the objective and deal with it then. But I would be fooling you if I said that, there are soccer fans who have a viewpoint, and there are people that want to protect the natural beauty of the area that have a viewpoint. And they're both right, and you've got to figure out how to come down on it.
A question I'll address first to Dr. Hartig, and then other people may want to chip in also. Why hasn't Golden Gate Park been landmarked?
Why hasn't Golden Gate Park been landmarked? Probably people in the audience know better than I do. It's certainly been talked about for a long time. I think part of the post-Union Square controversy has kind of cast its shadow over that. I think it's also been caught up in the changes that Prop J wrought, and sadly, I think it's been caught up in some of the broader and very real concerns, but also some of the hyped-up concerns over what a designation is and what a designation isn't. I certainly hope that it is, for the reasons I stated, because I think that there's a real powerful potential for a kind of coalesced review of changes to the park that would put certain ones into just easily categories. They conform to the 1998 plan. They will cause no significant environmental effect. You know, done. But the bigger ones, especially the beach chalet, soccer fields, I think deserve as rich a conversation as we can, including alternatives that are meaningful alternatives under CEQA.
What will landmarking mean? Will this pickle the park?
No, there is no pickling of the park. I'm here to tell you that. Yeah, I mean, you heard some of the examples I gave across the nation, and if pro-property rights Phoenix, my alliteration is. I'm sticking with the P's. If pro-property rights Phoenix, which, of course, I just threw in an F, but can landmark, locally designate 30 parks, I just cannot see any reason why San Francisco, in all its progressive glory, cannot landmark it, especially when I think it provides us an opportunity to take a look at the 98 plan and say, okay, what are the contributing historic features of this design cultural landscape? It's art and science, and I think that of anybody, of any community that we work with in the 8 Western states, San Francisco is fully equipped to do that and do it proudly and maybe make it a huge point of pride in the park, tie it together with fundraising. You know, kind of make the designation a real meaningful event in the history of the city and the park.
Okay.
I won't natter on. Okay.
Kathy, you're a landscape architect, and maybe you can help us with this. And what is the story on state-of-the-art synthetic turf, and how long will it last, and when will it need to be replaced? What kind of maintenance does it take?
I think there are two issues here. First of all, I don't think there's any doubt that synthetic turf does last longer. It can be played on longer during the week and during the year, and it requires somewhat less maintenance, although we've been looking at some of the figures, and we believe that there should be more maintenance than Rec and Park has talked about. In particular, some people are worried about MRSA and the turf being kept cleaned off and disinfected and things like that. So although water use might be less than lawn, on the other hand, it is supposed to be rinsed off quite a bit. But our position is not that synthetic turf is better or worse than grass fields in terms of a playing surface, exactly. Oh, and the other question is they have to be replaced about every 8 to 10 years. So in San Francisco, we've got, almost 30 acres now of synthetic fields, and in 8 to 10 years, the bill's going to come due on this stuff. If a grass field dies or isn't taken care of, you just go out there and water it and throw out some grass field. But for the synthetic turf, you're going to have to go out and you're going to have to replace it, and I've heard $200,000 to $600,000, depending. The other thing is that we think that if you do the natural grass fields in the park, that yes, they won't last as long as the synthetic turf, but we think with good field construction, the right soil amendment, a better irrigation system. If you look on Google Earth right now, you're going to see the crop circles, which means you have a poor irrigation system, and gopher controls for those cute but pesky little gophers, that the field can last longer. And then we would like to take the money that's being spent on this particular field, which is up to $12 million, we'd like to take $1 million and fix up the field. And we like to use that money for artificial turf fields, which we are not opposing in principle, in other parts of the city. We like to spread it around so we can meet the playing time that Mr. Buell was talking about. I think it would be better to have, instead of a Rolls Royce of a project, to have a bunch of minivans.
Mm-hmm. You've practiced that.
I did. I did, yeah. Practice that. Yes.
Mark. Do we know where the new soccer players are coming from, and how many of these are San Franciscans, and how many are regional leagues, and how many are children who won't be playing at night? And
well, I didn't bring exact statistics, but we're woefully short of the requested number fields for the requested number of games. And if you go down to the Marina Green and see during the summertime all the soccer fields for kids that are laid out there, and weather permitting, they operate. So there's really a long-term program to try and meet the demand in a way that best serves the public.
Okay. Mike, do you have some prescriptions for how the park can move forward and also improving wildlife habitat in the long run?
Well, I think that the park would be well served by really trying to come up with a better habitat management plan. I think there's a lot of sort of ad hoc work done right now. And a good example that's been given to me by folks that go into the park a lot is every few years, usually related to some criminal or illicit activity, the park feels the need to clear out brush. And brush is, scrub and shrubs and leaf litter is an important ecological fixture in the park. But people are worried that someone may lurk and hide in there. And there can be legitimate safety concerns about that. So they'll go through and they'll clear it all out. And then a couple years later, they'll go in and plant it all back again. And what it shows is that there hasn't been a real long-term plan on how they want to manage that habitat overall. And I think that they can do that. This goes a little bit to the idea of trying to work in partnership better with people like Jake Sigg and folks that really know the park well and know the ecology of the park well. And I think the park would benefit from that immensely. And we've seen some of that in the Natural Areas Program, but we haven't seen that through other aspects of park management. And I think that was, again, something that kind of set us off with the Beach Chalet soccer field, because that was never discussed before. It was just presented that was the way it was going to be, and perhaps we could have – and they only did the EIR after we got up a little up in arms about it. So I think working with the community a little better would be the best way to proceed and rely on the expertise of folks that have been out there for decades.
Yeah, we have a general lack of trust of government that's all through the United States these days.
Very American notion, I think.
Yeah, all through every department in San Francisco. But do we have some ideas here how we can try and rebuild that kind of trust that's so necessary to have in a democracy? And this is a question for any of you.
Well, let me give a couple examples. I think one of the best ones I've seen in the last couple of years is, Gloria Koch-Gonzalez deserves credit for this, as well as Josiah Clark, of getting restoration going at the bison paddock of coastal scrub habitat. And coastal scrub habitat has been decimated up and down California with significant effects to the biota that rely on it. And those guys have gotten volunteers out there every month for going on a couple of years. And this year they have breeding white-crowned sparrows out there. And white-crowned sparrow is a very common bird, but that we've been observing in decline for years as they have lost their coastal scrub habitat. So it's a real success story between the park working with private citizens to bring stewards into the land.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and our panel members who are talking to us about the future, present and future of Golden Gate Park. We have come to that point in our program where we have one final question to be asked. And after that question is asked, we will ask each member of the panel to give us a one-minute summary. And again, I want to remind you, this is civil discourse.
Kathy, you're dying to say something. And
I hate to take the last question, but I will.
Yeah.
I think when you're talking about democracy and government, that there's something that we haven't really brought up here, and it isn't specific to Golden Gate Park, and my apologies to Mr. Buell, but it is specific to the Department and the Recreation and Park Commission. And this is not the fault of the commissioners, but it has to do with the structure of the commission. People may not know that the general manager is appointed by the office of the mayor, and the whole Rec and Park Commission is appointed by the office of the mayor. So what you have is you have basically a 7-person commission and the general manager who are all appointed by the same person. Now, I don't think people are taking direction or anything like that, but what I do think is that when you are friends with somebody or they know you well enough to appoint you, then you're going to have a common viewpoint and common opinions about things and common values. Last year, many of us were concerned about this, And there was an effort to change this appointment procedure to the commission. And during testimony at the Board of Supervisors, it was brought up that of 130 consecutive decisions by the Rec and Park Commission, all of them were approved of the project, and 127 of them were approved unanimously. This is an extraordinary record. You will not find that in the Planning Commission, where you have a 4-3 process, where the Board of Supervisors appoints three, the four by the mayor, and there's always a swing vote. And I think swing is probably a good way of describing what often happens at that meetings. And we would like to see that kind of interaction and discussion and discourse going on. And I think this would go a long way towards people feeling a lot more comfortable with a lot of the decisions that were made, and would give more of a variety of San Franciscans more input into the park and more decision-making about their parks.
Okay, we now have 1 minute for last comments from each panelist, and we'll start with George Wooding.
Thank you, Jim. I just want to mention, I'll just stick with Kathy's theme for a second. Basically, for trust, you have to have discussion and discourse. I think what we had in our own neighborhood, I oversee many neighborhood groups. We have the Rec and Park come in. They have over $500,000 in salary. People come in, talk to us at a brand new facility that spent $3.9 million just to open, and they fired the Rec and Park director. So now they can't keep it open. So they have a problem. So now they're going to bring in some kind of for-profit entity for $1,500 a month in rent. And I think these are the kind of things that fester with the neighborhoods. When we go to meetings, I don't go anymore, really, because I don't feel anyone's going to listen to me. I don't think my point of view has any value in terms of the decision's already been made. The mayor made it. The director made it. The commission's made it. So I think there's a long way to go with trust. Thank you.
Mike.
I want to just go back to this notion that as we make these decisions, and we hopefully have more of these sort of robust discussions, that one, that they occur in as transparent a process as possible, and so that we do know, for example, what are these discussions going on with concessionaires and the Rec and Park staff and partnerships that are open and to the public and that we can all as citizens contribute to. But when we do this and we make these decisions as a community, that we think about what our contribution is, as I was saying, to biodiversity and to the natural environment that we've been given to, that we've been given, and what we are going to pass down. And the fact that I want to leave you with is that when we talk about the loss of San Francisco's ecosystem and the loss of birds and other wildlife, that these are very real things that are happening every single day in San Francisco. And that unless we as individuals take responsibility and make decisions, even when it's inconvenient, even when it means a little less soccer, or that we have to walk a little further, or that we don't get one particular thing that we want, that we make those decisions in order to preserve San Francisco's natural history as a community. Thank you.
Kathy Howard.
I think it all, for Golden Gate Park, it all comes down to this. What do we want Golden Gate Park to be? Do we want it to be a series of paved, permitted attractions with a few trees kind of here and there to remind us that it used to be a park? Or do we want to be at a place where a child can watch a heron hunting in a field, a place with birds to bless us with their songs, a place for all ages of people to enjoy various activities during the day? But at night, when they go home and darkness falls, it becomes parkland again and returns to nature. This is the Golden Gate Park that we have now, and this is the park we should protect for future generations. My group, the Golden Gate Park Preservation Alliance, will release a new video in a few weeks by a talented young filmmaker named Dexter Ho. Turn into our website, watch the video, and join us, please, to help protect Golden Gate Park.
And Thea Hartig.
Thank you. I would hope that we can move towards a holistic sense of stewardship of this remarkable historic, cultural, and ecological resource that we call Golden Gate Park. I think we're well equipped to do that together. And I would hope that we could act not in unison, but in a sense of collaborative and meaningful discourse. I think as we have here tonight and seeing glimpses of that, to find out those best paths forward to create that sustainable future. I think one of the things we have not talked about tonight that I think we all need to get our arms around are the impacts of global climate change on especially that edge of San Francisco and what really we're talking about that really we weren't talking about in 1998 as much as probably as we should have been, and to think really about how are we going to adapt in, to huge changes as the park is facing. And if we think vendors might be troublesome, you know, let's get up on the balcony and really kind of look down at that incredible resource and see what we need to do together. Thank you.
Mark Buell.
Well, let me respond on the issue of the commission. The Planning Commission has principally takes up items that are initiated by the public. The Recreation and Park Department takes up principally issues that have to do with management and care of the park initiated by staff. Under the charter, the general manager reports to me, and I would never put an item in front of the commission that wasn't thoroughly thought out and where staff wasn't recommending something for the benefit of the public. So the idea of comparing those votes is not fair. We have lots of debate, and there are, and we have changed the system of having more committee meetings to air these issues before they get to the full commission to try and resolve conflict. I would say that Golden Gate Park, it's a treasure, and it is this competition between recreation and nature, and I think it's a competition between resources and how you allocate them. And so I don't really take issue with much that was said up here. I think people genuinely believe in their hearts and are good advocates for those issues. But I could have had a panel of soccer players, and I could have had a panel of recreation users, and et cetera. And so I just encourage you all, come to our meetings, debate the issues, let us know how you feel. And we welcome the attention. Thank you.
Tonight we've heard a broad discussion of the threats to Golden Gate Park, a very real financial threat that is affecting all city departments and Rec and Park in particular, and a number of proposed changes to the park that many civic organizations see as ill-considered. The challenge before us is to find ways to adequately fund park operations while improving the park experience. That is, new park features and policies must be in accord with the publicly adopted Golden Gate Park Master Plan, a plan that acknowledges the park's history, its ecological values, and social importance. What I have heard is that even as we search for new financial models, we must keep Golden Gate Park Master Plan as the overriding framework and look for ways to protect the park in the context of the plan while exploring ways to finance its care and maintenance. I've heard we should strive for balance, that we should base our work on facts, that we should use best practices, we should strive for collaborative management, and work to build trust among all of us. The Golden Gate Park Master Plan says, quote, "The plan is intended to provide a framework and guidance to ensure responsible and enlightened stewardship of the park. The goal is to manage the current and future park and recreation demands while preserving the historic significance of the park. As such, the plan is a preservationist plan, and proposed changes must respect the historic context of the park," end quote.
You have been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and our panel members who have been talking to us about the challenges now and ahead for Golden Gate Park. Our thanks to Jim Chappell and our panelists Mark Buell, Athena Hartig, Catherine Howard, Mike Lyons, and George Wooding for their coming and being with us tonight and sharing with us their thoughts and observations. We also thank our audiences here on radio, television, and network. I very much appreciate all that you have said to us and the questions that have been asked by the audience, and I think the panel has really been exemplary and special to, for us to hear tonight. I wish now to invite you, since I made the other comment, to give them all a huge round of applause. I'm Ann Clark, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 109 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.
Good job, Jim.